next session with 32747, Rule 2.
Yes, yeah, so you're on working parties?
Yeah, we collect these and give these to the guys.
What were they you were collecting?
Snails, yeah. Give them to the guy that would do the cooking, tiffin if you like, and they would break off, boil them, mix them with the rice. So instead of just getting boiled rice, you might, well, for the sake of taste, they just like little bits of liver, which was nice. And on one occasion, for a week, we were working near the coast, and quite a lot of Australians with us. And one of the Aussies had been a fisherman, and he made what I'd call a fishing trap out of bamboo. We were allowed to go out for a swim when the tide was, and he asked the Jap, could he anchor this fish trap while the tide was out, and next day when the tide came in, it would bring a lot of fish in. When it went out, and it was full of fish. So he gave the Jap his choice, and we had the rest for tiffin. One of the nice things that happened. And another pleasant affair, we were having a yasumi, and it was a big palm tree, as much shade as we get, but it was a coconut palm tree, and there were monkeys up the tree. It wasn't unusual. And we've laid back that, and Jock, my mate, he had his cigarette tin. You see that little tin there, my love? On that set on the first shelf. That, I'll give you a little story about that. We made those in Bandung from pieces of aluminium. Jock and I made the box, and I inscribed them with, in my case, the RF crest and my initials.
Oh, isn't that beautiful?
And we sold these to any guys that were dealing in the black market. Yes, it opens, and it was called our making tin. You keep your tobacco in that. And Jock and I did quite a roaring trade. And when the officers heard about it, well, of course they had money, so we doubled the price.
That is absolutely beautiful.
And that is exactly that type of box. Jock flagged out, and it was lay alongside him, and the sun must have glinted on it. One of the monkeys streamed down the tree, pinched the cigarette box, shot up the tree. We wakened up, and Jock said, now, we'd been told how to get coconuts off the monkeys. You throw anything up at them to annoy them, not to hit them, to annoy them. So there's plenty of rockery, like three or four of us throwing, and they in turn threw coconuts. It sounds ridiculous, but it's true. They twisted the coconut, threw down. Monkey knowledge.
Yes.
When all the coconuts had gone, the monkey hole in the tin was still annoyed, so we threw the tin back. So Jock got his cigarette box back. Yeah, that's one of my little treasures.
I bet it is. It's beautiful. What was Jock's full name, real?
Jock Philibin. He's actually in the boot, Meg.
Is he?
In
the prisoners in Java?
Before you go, I'll show you. Cause what happened... Well, this you wouldn't want to record, I don't know. Well, my recollection in Java, I don't recall any officers coming out on working parties. And I do recall that in Bandung, the officers were segregated from us. In fact, after we were captured, the only time I saw my CO was when Ivor Delange, this guy in my unit who died, he'd had an unfortunate accident with on a working party with an axe. It had gone gangrenous, and poor Ivor passed away. And we were allowed, what do you believe, in Bandung to bury him outside the camp in a, I can only assume, from what I remember, it was a Jewish area of a cemetery. And a Hebrew, what I call Padre, came and officiated. And that is the only time I ever saw my CO. I never ever saw him again. He made no contact with us. For whatever reason, I don't know.
Who was that?
Flight Lieutenant Garrity.
Right.
But there is a sequel, my love. When I came home, knowing that poor Ivor had passed away, my wife and I had the pleasure of meeting his family while we were on leave waiting to go out. Ivor was a very wealthy man. He was a director of Christie Towels. You remember the big towel company? And we struck a very close affinity. And I always used to say to him, "What are you doing in the Air Force at 31? Oh, he said, "Well," he said, "we'd probably get called up sooner or later." Having met his family, they lived in a beautiful big house in Bowden in Cheshire. We'd met his mum and dad, his sister, and he took us there for, we had a nice meal. So I took Hilda over to meet the family, because we didn't even know whether they'd heard that he passed away. We got there, his dad had passed away during the war. His father owned a big rainproof company in Manchester. I can remember his dear old mum, what you'd affectionately call a Yiddish mama, weeping and wailing. Very, you know, my Ivor's not come. Very uncomfortable. But his sister was very much more controlled. And we talked with her. And she said, she showed me a letter from the Air Ministry. "We regret that your brother Ivor Delange died in Bandung, died in Sumatra and was buried there." We'd never been in Sumatra. So I said, right. So I wrote to the Air Ministry and asked, could they supply the address of my commanding officer? I don't know how long it took, but eventually I got a letter with his bank address. And any correspondence had to go to his bank address. So I wrote a letter and said that I'd contacted Ivor Delange's family and they were concerned because I told them he died in Bandung, in Java. And I said, I would like you to confirm it because you were there, you were his commanding officer. So he did that and he wrote back to me and said, "Many thanks for your blah blah, Whitehead." Yes, he said, and the wording I can't remember, one phrase was, "It was a bitter pill to swallow when we had to surrender." I thought that was a mild way of putting it, a bitter pill to swallow. And that was the only time with my own CO. The other, what I call satisfying association, we were building the tunnel, building the aerodrome, and we had one guy used to be in a tent brewing up tea, and it was next to the Japs, what we call the squeegee bar, that's Japanese kitchen. And the guy that was normally doing our job was off sick, so Captain Schulte, an Aussie, German by origin, big strong guy, blonde hair. And I got quite friendly with him because he was a rugby player. And I played a bit of rugby. Anyway, in conversation, if the war hadn't have occurred, he'd have come over to England in the Australian rugby team. But, right. We were running short of tea. So I went under the flap of the Japanese tent. I remember this. Because I knew there'd be some there. And there was a tea chest. I just got two hands in there with two big handfuls of tea, and the Malayan cook came in that was looking after Japs. He let out a yell, Japanese soldier came in, and I stood there with two handfuls of tea. I thought, well, it's going to happen now. But the commotion had been heard. Captain Schulte rushed in, and he virtually did exactly what Major De Niro did. He talked over the Japanese, and in pidgin, Japanese and the Japs' little pidgin understanding of English, he explained that the men were very thirsty, and if they didn't have tea, they couldn't work very hard. And so I'd come in the tent to. So I don't know what the exact wording was, because I was still stood with his handful of tea, and the Japanese agreed that we could have some tea. So if we'd have asked for it, I'd have got it. But I was going to pinch it. So we got some more tea.
You were lucky again.
Again?
Yeah.
That's twice I was prevented from having a beating because of an officer.
Tell me about the first instance with
Major De Niro.
Yes. Now, who was he? Who was Major De Niro?
He was... I'm not sure what regiment, but he was an army major. But he came out on the working party.
What nationality was he?
From Malta. A big Maltese, yeah. Because when we got back to camp, he came and had a chat with us, and we saw him quite often then on the working party, you know. But the point really is, Meg, that the officers, they didn't have to work, but they did, some of them, voluntary. Now, you've seen that film, of course, The River Kwai. Well, I don't know. To me, it was a bit of just a publicity stunt by the Americans, you know. That sort of thing never happened. You couldn't imagine a British officer agreeing to do the job better than the Japanese and saying, leave it, a bit of hogwash, you know. Mm. But it sold a lot of seats in cinemas, didn't it?
Yeah, indeed. Indeed it did.
So that was the only two occasions I had personal experience with officers, you know.
Explain to me what Major De Niro had happened that day that he intervened.
Well,
was it you and
Jock again? Jock Philbin.
You were on a working party.
Yeah.
Tell me again.
And we were felling palm trees, and these would be carted to fill the swamps to firm the ground ready for the tarmac for the aerodrome. And whatever conversation that day, Jock and I stopped working, and of course the Japs spotted us. Kura, you know, Bagheera, and the usual Jap. And so on. So he made us stand to get back to back, and we knew then we were going to get punished. All right, it was our own fault. We should have carried on working, but we didn't. And with the commotion and with the Jap shouting, that was Major De Niro was informed. He rushed up the hill, talked over the Japanese soldier, and told us to bugger off. And he kept the Japanese occupied, and we vanished. And we made sure that we went farther down the working area so the same Jap wouldn't spot us again. So there's no doubt about it, it was through him that we... But I've seen guys get, well, you've heard of it, unmercifully beaten for the slightest. Because a lot of the Japs were very, I don't know, nervous, or they'd lose their temper very quickly. The only time I ever got bashed, it was building the drone. We were carrying... Oh, no, sorry, my love. It was building the tunnels in Kranji Valley. Mm-hmm. And we were carrying pit props about 12, 15 inches in diameter, ready to shore up the ceilings in the tunnels. There's two guys at the front, two guys at the back. I was one at the back. One of our guys stumbled at the front. Down came the 8, 9, 10 foot long... Trapped him underneath. We pulled it off to help him because he was hurt. The Jap guard panicked, as they often did. I just happened to be the nearest to him, so I got it. Woof! And
was that a punch?
Oh, a punch. At first, in the early days, it was a slap, but then they found out. That's why a lot of our guys came home with busted eardrums.
Right.
And okay, he belted me, and we were more concerned. But then he saw. Well, blood trickling down. I don't know what he used, whether it was a handkerchief. He poured water out of his water, wiped the blood off my face and gave me a cigarette. Once he'd calmed down, he realised that it was nobody's fault, but I just happened to be there, and somebody had to be blamed. Yeah. That was a good example.
That was Jap logic.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, by and large, would you say that relationships in camp were fairly harmonious between the prisoners, between different ranks?
Oh, yeah. In fact, different regiments, I mean, Army, Navy, because we're all in the same boat. I do recall, Meg, that in all the camps I was in, the officers were always segregated. They were never in the area where the other ranks were, you know. Mm. I mean, let's say... Warrant officers down were all in the, particularly in Changi Jail. But in Changi Jail, a lot of the officers came out on the working parties, mm-hmm. both on the drone. But the last job in the Kranji Valley, the only time we had any contact, and this is quite true, was when the first atom bomb was dropped. We were in ATAP huts that we built ourselves, and a young group captain came in, Oria, and he said, we'd come in from work. He said, now, don't make any noise, I'm going to tell you something. And they'd got a wireless, our officers, we didn't know that. And they'd heard about the first bomb on Hiroshima. They said, we don't know, excuse me,